Hello and welcome to Super Saturdays, a comic book media podcast where each episode we will be focusing on your favorite comic books, TV shows, and movies to figure out if these projects will stand the test of time. I'm Damon A, and on today's episode, I am joined by a fantastic guest.
Jason Douglas, author of a couple of comic books, a dude who came to it late, started my stuff, a little bit, let's call it middle age, full-time teacher the last 25 years. I'm making my dreams come true now.
On with the show. Jason, it is great to have you on the show. I'm happy you reached out and everything. And after doing a little bit of deep dives on you and figuring more about you, and even just us talking prior to recording and everything, you have a very interesting career so far.
Yeah, this is not job one, right? Like my day job is a public school teacher, last 25 years, 2.5 decades. I don't get to stay up late at night anymore. So my other day job is making comics.
Okay. So you're a father, you're a teacher, and you also work on comics. So when it comes to working with comics, has your teaching job and also just being, you know, a dad kind of seeped its way into the type of comics you work on?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I don't, you know, there's that old cliche that no matter what medium you write in, that, like, you know, write what you know. So, like, when you live a life, it's going to... the most magical realism fiction, like, parts of you are always going to be in your writing. But I'll tell you what, I'm not even going to talk writing process for a second. One of the most mind-blowing things, or kind of like eureka or really cool realizations, lightning strike moments that I've had over the last couple of years, which has been a fantastic, wonderful experience, because here's what you got to understand. I have been a comic fan and reader exponentially longer than I've been a creator, right? You know, this is something that is like passionate in me since I was like 12 years old, a little, and then the creation part has been like this dream that on the back burner since then. So we're talking decades before I got off my butt and wrote my first script. So here I am, like, in my 40s, experiencing these things through the eyes of a 12 to 15 year old. You know, I'm getting all that first time thing, but with like decades of life and experience. So I got to savor that first time a page of art came in that came out of my letter, you know, came out of my words. I got to savor that first time that I was in previews. I got to savor the first time I held a physical copy of my book in my hand. I got to savor kind of the magical moments of my first book when it sold out and got me 2 Ringo nominations and got me to the award ceremony where I got to gracefully lose both categories to the guy who writes Batman, you know? Like all those things, I got to see that for the first time. And one of the most magical moments of that was when I realized when, you know, conventions came back post the worst of COVID, and I started to get to go to shows and do signings, all the stuff that canceled the first time out for my first book, and how much the skills of the classroom, especially the middle school classroom where I am, translated directly to the experience of being on this other side of the table now, right? The from the mechanics of the repetition, right? Like I teach 8th grade ELA, I teach middle schoolers, which means I'm teaching that same lesson 6-7 times a day. And if I'm doing my job, that dumb joke I make in second hour about grammar to try to make them think that it's actually interesting and not boring as it is, 7th hour shouldn't know that it's the first time. They should think it's the first time they're hearing it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's a performative aspect. And the other thing that was really kind of brilliant was just the interacting with people and how much those things kind of line up with each other. We're human beings. We all have good days and bad days. If I'm doing my job in the classroom, if I'm doing my job on that side of the table, you're coming to see me, you should never know. Your interaction with me should be me giving you everything. Like, it's an honor to teach children. It's an honor and a privilege to be standing on the creator side of the table and somebody's coming up and is interested in what you've created. You know, I always say that one of the most formative things when I was, you know, becoming a teacher, when I was going to school to do that, when I was thinking about it when I was younger than that, was watching everybody else do it absorbing the good, absorbing the bad, and deciding who I was going to be based on, well, not that, definitely that, and accumulating that and turning that into what was me. Same exact thing for who I am behind the table now. When I was going to conventions as a fan, meeting this hero, meeting that hero, and finding out that that wasn't a very nice human, and that person was brilliant and gave me more time than any fan ever deserves, and like let that be formative on who I am in the classroom and definitely who I am behind the table. And that's been one of the kind of crazy things about, like, oh my God, it's like a one-to-one transfer.
That was a lot of information. Like, you know, honestly, I feel moved for it on some real shit. Like, I really did. And I did not expect that. But that was a good answer. That really was. You know, you talked about
I hope to give you several good answers today.
What do you love about comics? And how exactly did you get into the comic book world? Like becoming a fan, you know, your first comic, that type of stuff. Because I know you touched on how you're about 12 years old.
Well, I'm going to answer that first question first. And I'm going to steal a quote from a movie that I love. A movie that is about something that other people are just as passionate about as like people like you and I are about comics. And so to answer your question, what do I love about comics? To begin with, everything. Okay. I think it is the most magical, malleable medium that is in existence. It does everything that film does and a bunch of stuff film doesn't. It does many of the things that prose does and a whole bunch of stuff that prose doesn't. And it's this meeting in the middle that does not have boundaries with what the storytelling is. And one level up from what's special about comics being this kind of this amazing storytelling medium is, I think, indie comics, because they don't have 80 years of editorial mandate saying what you can and cannot do. You can tell any story. There is no budget. Well, making your comic and putting in the world, that's a different story. You know, I'm running a Kickstarter right now. There is definitely a budget, but you know what I mean. There's no film budget. There's no limitation of where your imagination go in your sets. There's no a limitation of you need this many jokes or explosions. It can be the smallest story, the biggest story. The limitation is what you can create. I love comics. I love comics because they changed the way I teach. Man, I did my first 13 years in the elementary school classroom. And I was banging my head against this problem the first couple of years of reluctant readers and below grade level readers having that stigma of, I would rather during reading time read an 800 page book upside down or backwards and admit that I'm at a first grade level when I'm in fourth grade. And I couldn't crack it. This is like early 2000s, right? And I realized that the answer was in a bunch of long boxes at my house. And I started bringing comics in the classroom and the world changed. Scholastic bought Bone in like 2003, 2004. And I started bringing that in the classroom and the world changed. There is no stick. Comics are cool for kids. You know what I mean? And you would have there's grade level everything, right? I mean, there's pre-K reading stuff. I brought Owly into the classroom by Andy Rutten. And suddenly you got this kid who literally can't put two words together, who is doing narrative progression and learning how to read. And no shame in it because there's a comic in his hand. And I love comics for that. I love comics for the lives that they change. I love comics for the stories they tell and how they can tell it and how there's no limitation. And I love comics now. Here's the big one. And this is only 4.5, 5 years old for me. I love comics because now every time I read one, I see the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into every single piece of production, whether it's 22-page floppy or 150-page OGN. I can feel the effort because I've been there, and it means more to me every time I read something now. Was that an okay answer?
That was a good answer. Okay. We're not even like taking score over what is being answered over here because it's not that type of show. But like, goddamn, love your passion. Love your passion. Love your passion.
Well, I'm not even gonna, I'm gonna tell you another thing. So I came to him late. I told you 12 years old. I did not have comics when I was like eight. I'm the oldest of two as far as siblings go. I did not have cool parents. I did not have parents who turned me on to music or turned me on to movies or turned me on to comics or turned me on to baseball cards. I didn't have an older cousin that was nearby. I didn't have that cool kid down the street who told you what to like before you were ready to like it. And then you form your own thing.
Discovered.
So I came to everything late.
Okay.
But I got this, this high functioning OCD, this high functioning collector mentality. So what that meant was when I got there, even if it was a year or two later than everybody else, once I was in, I was in. So like I come from the era of CDs, right? There are no greatest hits CDs on my shelves downstairs. You either are out or I want all of it. And when I hit comics, same thing, right?
They got now, you. They just snatched you up.
Dichotomy though, like half and half. I am half collector and half reader. So sometimes they're warring, right? Because they don't always agree, right? But like half of me is just pure. I'm there for the story. I'm there for the art. I will follow you if I love you as a writer to the end of the earth, no matter what you produce. The other half of me is chasing grails, and chasing covers, and chasing runs. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so like that was me from day one. Now I did that thing that I don't think is atypical, especially people my age, where somewhere in my mid late teens, I dropped off for about 9 years. Okay. I was out, with two exceptions. There were two books like I took with me to college and beyond before I got back in a comic shop and got rehooked. And that was Neil Gaiman's Sandman and Art Spiegelman's Mouse. So like two towering giants of the industry, two massive, you know, pieces of literature that stand on their own, even for skeptics of comics. You know, I mean, Mouse won the freaking Pulitzer Prize in 1992. I mean, give me a break, you know. So I got back in like in 2004 and have been absolutely hooked, still 50-50 down the middle ever since.
So you would say those two were the ones that really just got you right back into it?
I mean, those are the two that followed me through, right? So like, if you look at me from the age of 12 to call it like 16, maybe even 17, I was doing the thing, right? When that Death of Superman came out, Superman 75 in the black bag, I was in line, right? I bought two copies. When Extinction Agenda, X-Men, with the cool holograms that people thought were stickers and were trying to pull them off. You know, I was there for those covers, that die cut Wolverine number 50 with the claws coming through it on the yellow cover. Like I needed that less for the Wolverine story, more because that was a wicked cool cover. At the exact same time, my pull list at my local shop was every single vintage Valiant Universe book. Because I was just reading that stuff and consuming it and the whole shared universe. When they were publishing 12 titles or 8 titles or even up to like 20 titles, I was buying every single one every month to follow that larger story. That dichotomy was with me from the beginning. And those like were my jams. Like I looked at those wall books when Image came out. Like Image and Valiant are kind of like parallel, the breakoff companies from Marvel and DC in the early 90s. And like I bought Image books because they were cool as a collector. Like I wanted to Spawn number one, not because the story was super great, but because the art was wicked cool and it was up on the wall and it had value and whatever. The collector in me wanted that Spawn number one. I wanted every Valiant book because I wanted to read them. And like, even at like 12 years old, 13 years old, like, half of me was so much about the reading. Like I was reading Sandman Mystery Theater, which is a 1930s noir book without a superhero in sight, you know, realistic, non-muscly art by Guy Davis, heady adult stories. And I loved it just as much as I loved Spider-Man because I really, really just liked comics. And like that kind of, you know, half of this and half of that, picked right back up in 2004 when I was back in there. 2004, I'm like, ooh, you got to get that because that's a really cool variant cover, or that looks really good. And I got to get that because, oh my God, this Walking Dead book that Kirkman's writing, that sounds like a good story. I'm following that because I want to read every issue. Do you know what I mean?
No, I get it. I get it. So would you say even today you're still like a collector, or is it more so? Oh, 100%.
Just there are long boxes in the basement that someday will create a problem for somebody because my children are not interested. And at some point, my wife will go in that back room and see how many boxes there actually are and be very, very alarmed. Yeah. Oh, I mean, my God. Like, if you look at the shelves behind me, if like anybody who can see it there, I mean, half of that is graphic novels, and there's more shelves like that downstairs. And that's right there. Like, what you see out is what I read. And then you go back in the nerd cave and there's the long boxes. And there's the top loaders to keep the valuable ones safe. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's split into the two parts of the house, the two parts of comic person that I am.
You know, I'm just imagining you down there. Someone stumbles across it. You get down there like Gollum, like, step away from my precious.
Well, there's that, or they're going to find me buried underneath it dead someday. Like the skeleton of me, like, where did he go? And I'm under like the shelf of long boxes fell over. And it's like some kind of ironic death.
Oh God! No, you're just gonna have like a piece of paper next to you, like, I died doing what I loved.
Yes, yeah. Like my wife calls it, like, are you down there playing with your comics? And I feel, dude, I feel like it's meant to be condescending, and then before I can like snap back, I'm like, yeah, I am. Yes, I absolutely am down here playing with my comics.
And so what? Mm-hmm. You know what? Love that for you. I love that. That sounds like the dream. All right. So, Jason, are you ready to dive into the meat and potatoes of what we're going to be talking about during this interview?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, let's dive in. Okay. So, we already talked a little bit about your career. I want to talk a little bit about, before we get into Jane American, which is your current project, tell me a little bit about Parallel. I know you talked about how you were nominated for Two Ringos and that was your first big project. What was that like? What was that like? What was it about?
It was this situation where, I think I mentioned this before. I mean, it is this dream that is just kind of sitting in the back of my head since I'm about 12. And yet this is a universal truth. It is always easier to do nothing than something. Okay. Mm-hmm. One of the main universal relatable themes in Parallel is about dreams deferred and how easy it is to know something that you have plenty of time to get to. And then you blink your eyes and 5 years have gone by, decades have gone by, and you're wondering if it's too late. And I was through my elementary school. And then when I was at the middle school level, I was writing a one act stage play every single year and putting it on with kids. And a couple of them got published. And I was like in this rhythm of writing a one act over the summer, doing a drama club, doing a audition rehearsals and put on a play, almost an 11 month of the year extra job. And one summer something clicked. And I said, you know what? This is great. This is wonderful. It's fulfilling. But I had this conversation with a former student of mine who was now pushing 30. And she told me about this, like this dream that she had about when she was 22, she was sure she was going to have this dance studio in Chicago within blah, blah, blah time frame. And she did one of those things that so many of us do where she's like, she deferred the dream, took a job to pay the bills because there's always going to be enough time. And she blinked her eyes and she's pushing 30. And now she thinks it's too late. And I had this idea, this sci-fi idea that I brainstormed with a buddy of mine, another comic nerd from college that we both went on to become teachers. And I had this lingering desire and I just sat down this one summer and I was like, it's time. How hard could it be, right? I'm already writing a play a year. How hard could it be to write a comic script? Now, I was blessed with some blissful ignorance, some irrational confidence because it is much harder. It is a bigger beast and a bigger animal. And I didn't know better. So I just sat down, found a template and started writing this script because it was finally time. And I wrote the first half of Parallel in a bubble, right? I mean, no expectation of what comes next, not really even fully knowing if I was doing it right, whatever. And about halfway through the process, I go, okay, I have put this amount of effort and this amount of time into it. What I need to do is I need to see if this is something that is viable, that can live and breathe in the world. And again, not knowing, being blissfully ignorant of how comics are made in the 21st century, I literally printed out copies, put it in a manila folder from school with beautiful little colored paper clips from my teacher desk, the cover letter. I'm like, I'm taking this Motor City Comic Con in Detroit and I'm going to hand it to a publisher and they're going to say, oh, that's interesting. Let's publish your comic. This is not how it works. This is not any comics are made in the 21st century. It's just not it. And I didn't know. And I didn't. And I walked in there with the confidence of somebody who just doesn't know better. And I walked up to this table and it happened to be Source Point Press, who was an indie creator that was literally exploding on the scene at this moment. And I walk up to this dude with this glorious red beard who just happens to be the founder and editor-in-chief, Travis McIntyre. And I walk up to this dude with the confidence of a million suns. And I'm just like, hey, let me tell you about my comic and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Not picking up on his body signals of you are weird and this is not how this is done. And eventually I wore him down and he cuts me off and he goes, I like the cut of your jib, but you're weird. And it's like you're trying to pitch me a comic in 1971. Leave it with me.
Ooh, not 1971.
I know. Like, I'm not, this is, I'm like decades out of date. And he's like, come back tomorrow and we'll talk about it. I'll read it tonight in the hotel. And I came back and he's like, we're in business. And suddenly a publisher has grabbed my script and he's like, you're going home and you're going to write the second half of this for me. And I'm like, yes, I am. And they held my hand because I'm telling you, if on that first project, I had to do what I've done on subsequent projects and everything was on me and you crowdfund first before you go to publisher, it probably would have been too much and it would have scared me back into that. It's not for me. And because he took me under his wing and they found me the artist and they found me the editor and they found me the letter and they took care of just about everything besides me writing it and then me going through the promotion of it because it's still indie comics. Mm-hmm. This thing lives and breathes in the world. Now, what's wild about Parallel, which is this dark sci-fi twisted tale, okay, it's kind of in the vein of an episode of Black Mirror or Twilight Zone. And it begs the question of you, the reader, what price would you pay for a second chance at all the dreams you thought you left behind forever? So Landon's kind of going through what the kids are calling the quarter-life crisis, right? Existential dread about time passing, dreams deferred. Did I make great decisions? Is it too late? It was obviously a bit of a midlife crisis that got me off my butt to write it in the first place. It's not exactly autobiographical because everybody goes through that those themes, right? Everybody has that point in their life where they're like, oh, crap, time is passing. What am I doing? For most of us, though, what is it? It's anxiety. It's dread. It's depression, however it manifests for you, however it manifests for me. But for Landon in our story, he starts hearing voices, starts seeing visions of an alternate version of himself reaching out, offering him that second chance of the dreams that he thought was closed forever. Unfortunately for him, not in his best interest physically and mentally in the here and now to pay that price. It gets really dark and hairy in the second half. This book now exists in the world. It's in previews, right? Diamond is putting it out there. Eventually, they cut a deal with Simon & Schuster. It's going to be on Amazon. It's going to be in Barnes & Noble. This is like amazing. Dream come true. Book drops into lockdown and flops. I mean, flops hard, okay? Even for the size that Source Point Press was at the time, it sold piddling copies. And here comes that blissful ignorance, irrational confidence to save the day again. I didn't know, and nobody told me that what you're supposed to do at that point is either give up and say, hey, I gave it a shot. I got farther than 99% of people, right? And walk away. Or if like you're a professional, it's what you do, you go, okay, that one didn't work, on to the next one. Nobody told me that. So what I did instead, and I was hinting, we were talking about this off the air. I go on this 18-month tour when there are no shows, are no signings, right? And that first almost year and a half of COVID. I go on an 18-month tour and do 75 interviews, not knowing that's not what you do. And the book starts picking up steam, word of mouth. Word of internet, and it sells out. Literally, I found out at Baltimore a year later that SourcePoint Press had to call up all the stores that automatically buy 10 copies of like all their books because they've got to deal with them, and had to buy back all their copies from all these stores across the country to meet the online demand that these interviews had created. And then this Ringo swell comes up, and I get nominated for my first book for best writer and best single issuer story. And I get to fly out to Baltimore. I get to present some awards. I get to give a little speech. I get to make people cry in the room because I tell that story about how comics changed all these kids' lives, because the Ringo Awards are named after Mike Ringo, who died really young of cancer. And that was the first book, one of Mike's books called Telos, that I brought in my classroom that changed kids' lives. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And then, as I said, I got to sit down and gracefully lose both categories to the guy who writes Batman. It was a heck of an experience. And that was my first book. It doesn't happen like that. It doesn't work like that. But if it didn't happen exactly that way for me, I don't think I am where I am right now, being able to self-sustain, create things, get out in the world, and then see if somebody else will grab onto it.
I think it's a circumstance that was right place, right time. Oh, like, you got the call, 100%. You picked up the call, and you're like, okay, you know what? We're running.
You know what's funny about that, though? I remember fairly early in some of those interviews, I was using the word luck a lot because I felt it. I felt I was really lucky to be here. I was really lucky when this domino fell, really lucky when that went to this and this connected to that and this led to this. And I had a bunch of people who were more experienced than me in the comic industry saying, dude, back off that word. I'm like, what are you talking about? I am lucky. And they're like, yeah. But when you overuse luck, especially when you're in indie comics, you are underselling the hard work that you have done, and especially everybody else behind the scenes have done. Mm-hmm. And it taught me a really interesting lesson about, yes, circumstances are lucky or whatever, but like, I worked really, really hard to get to that point. And my letter worked his butt off to make the book look like it did. And people behind the scenes at the publisher did job A and job Z to get me to that point and get us to that point. So like, I got to be really careful how to use that word and just saying, you know, circumstances fell where they did. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna cut this part out, but like, I'm learning a lot from you. Oh my gosh, this is really interesting. Very insightful.
No, we're having a good talk here. I'm telling you,
seriously,
man, like, I've done a lot of these, right? One, you're asking fantastic questions. Two, I always feel really good where I'm going off my script. Like, when an interview goes medium, when an interview goes off the rails bad, I've done enough of this, and I work on my feet all day with, like, you know, when you're getting heckled by a 14-year-old, you better be able to hold your stuff together or you're going to get eaten alive. You know what I mean? And so like, even like when it's a horrible interview, like, I've got things that I know I can say that will move things along and it'll get us to our point A to point B. My favorite types of interviews are the ones where that order gets jumbled and or I'm saying things that I know I haven't necessarily said before, and you're doing that. And so I'm having a really good time.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. You take that out. You keep that in because that is a compliment for you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that a lot. Yeah. I've been working on my interview skills, so I hope I'm doing good. You know, getting more into parallel, though, because actually this question is going to be something I didn't really prep for, but seeing as how you were talking about it, when it came for the idea of parallel, I know you touched on how it's not autobiographical, but it just hit something so unique within your circumstance with what your student went through and just everyday life stuff. When writing that, how much of yourself did you really have to like tap into to really truly understand those characters?
All of it. I think there's a little bit of me in every single character in that book. There's a little bit of everybody. Like, I think there's a couple of things that over the last 5 years I have really, really learned about myself as, I think, at least a comic book writer. And one of them is that the comic nerd in me, I think every project I do, it's going to be wrapped in a recognizable bit of comic nerd culture, right? And, you know, Parallel is this dark sci-fi kind of horror scary book, okay? Existential dread, but I mean, it's genre in that respect. You know, Jane American is wrapped in its kind of loose superhero genre. But at the core of, I think, everything I write are these universal, relatable themes that I don't care who you are, what you look like, what age you are, where you came from. These are relatable things that you're going to be able to connect to those ideas. The idea of time passing and freaking us out and the decisions we make and maybe you don't get a second chance. Like, there is not a human that doesn't go through that. The themes that we're going to talk about that are in Jane American, everybody goes through them. And I really like it. It's almost like a different version of what we talked about earlier of me as a reader slash collector, right? Like, the idea is I want to write a superhero story, or I want to write a dark horror sci-fi story, or I want to write a kid's adventure story, the new thing I'm working on. But I need that other piece too. I need that thing where it makes it more than just 20 minutes or 2 days of entertainment. I want it to be something that can resonate with people and something that can get inside you here and make you think about something or help you. You know, mental health is a huge theme of Parallel. And I will tell you, I didn't necessarily see this coming, but as feedback started to come on what this book meant to people that had read it, it made all the blood, sweat, and tears, all the ups and downs, and the couple year journey to get it out in the world and get it successful, it made it all worth it in an instant. And that was the first person of a lot who said to me in a chat when I was doing an interview, or reached out to me on Instagram and said, you know what, man, I read your book and I feel less alone. I felt like I was alone going through this thing, and I realized everybody goes through this thing. And I talked to my mom about it. I talked to my partner about it. I talked to my buddy about it. I went to get professional help about it, because going through it alone was putting me in a dark spiral, just like your character. And the first person that said that, I was like, I don't care if I don't sell another copy. I don't care what else I hear about this book. That made it all worth it. And I'm hoping that at the core, and the same thing with Jane American, like, there, when you read it, you connect to it, and it means something more than just, like I said, that moment of entertainment, which has its own value. Don't get me wrong, but I like the fact that I think who I am as a writer is finding the balance between the two things.
I'm gonna have to do some serious editing. Every single answer you're giving,
okay,
insightful, down to the core, very precise. I'm having a really good time interviewing you. I'm learning some shit.
I don't know. I don't know how else to talk about it, because it's how I feel about it, right? Mm. But like, when I think about how much time and how much effort goes into making an indie comic specifically, and I think about the very, very relative, minuscule financial reward, if there is one at all, I don't know how you could do it without this amount of passion for it. Like, it doesn't, like, the equation doesn't work for me. Like, I can't, like, if I cared half as much as I care about this new book, there's no way in hell I would be able to go through what I've gone through to bring it to reality. The financial sacrifices that I've made, the time sacrifices that I've made. Do you know what I mean? Like, I this is something you don't know about me, but like, in the middle, so like post-Parallel and right when the green light of, okay, let's move ahead with what Jane American will eventually become, and then Parallel Special Edition, which was because the first one sold out and we did like the big expanded edition with all the good back matter, I got diagnosed with colon cancer. And like, it derailed life. It derailed my plans for comics. And it's like, man, if I cared 1 ounce less, like, I don't know how, unless you're super passionate about this thing, you could be a dad, be a husband, teach full time, live life, maybe catch a couple hours of sleep and make comics. Like, you have to love it, right? You have to love it.
I got a question. one of the biggest, and I haven't read Parallel, but one of the biggest things you mentioned is that time is one of the biggest themes of that entire story. You came up with that story out of your head. It came out of your mind. Did you find yourself reflecting on what it is that you worked on and really thinking about how, like, wow, it's kind of interesting that, like, it's kind of mirroring where I'm at right now?
Yes and no. I mean, yes and no. Yes, in the respect that you get a moment here and there to reflect upon it. But no, because tomorrow keeps on coming. And whether tomorrow held surgery to cut the tumor out of me, or tomorrow held I got a swim meet to go to watch my kid, or tomorrow held I got to convince 180 teenagers that nouns are interesting, or even tomorrow held a convention or a new page to write of a new book, time's limited. But yeah, I mean, I look back at it, I think probably when I talk to people like you right now, and I look back and I think, how amazing was that? And yet, I'll tell you what, it's like everything else in life. I look at people that I admire that are creative. And I could sit there and, like, if I got a sit down, if I was like on the other side of this interview and I was in your position and I was talking to, I don't know, a creator that I loved, or an actor that I loved, or a musician that I loved, and then I wanted to probably just talk about that one thing that they did blah, blah, blah years ago, and I could sustain 40 hours of questions on it. When, I mean, you know that cliche, right, where that musician who's clearly washed up and over the hill, and they're like, I'm writing the best music I've ever written. And you're like, no, dude. That was like 40 years ago. That your second album is your best. You know, face reality, let's talk about that. And they're always like, I don't look back. I don't look forward. I'm fine looking back. But, like, I can't only do that, because then that admits to me, I mean, I got as much imposter syndrome as the next person, and I don't want to admit that I'm a one-trick pony. I don't want to look back and I'm a fan of stand-up comedy. And there's this thing where, you know, in the last about 15 years, the trend has been to create a new hour every year, and you go out and tour that and you make a special, and that's burned, and you can never go back to the material. But for decades, the way comics worked was they could tour 30 minutes or an hour, depending on where they were as a headliner or a middle or whatever. And they would tour that exact same material for like a decade or two. And I have no desire to be like the never ending Parallel tour. Like, I am about to, at my next show, I will sell out of the very last copies that I've got of Special Edition. Am I going to buy more? I don't know. Am I going to sell more? I have no idea. I haven't really decided on that yet. And as much as I love it, and as much as it's first, as much as I can talk about it all day, it's like, you know, forward progress. It's like a shark. You know, you keep swimming or you die. You know, there's only so much I can dine out on the success of that first book. I got to create more stuff. I mean, that fire is still in my belly, and I am not going to quench it or squash it for the sake of a book that I already wrote. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I sound like I'm crapping on my first experience, my first book. Oh my God, it's the magical thing that got me here. I love it more than anything. And yet here I am. Like, I feel like I'm being way too negative about it.
I don't think you're being negative about it though. Yeah. I don't think you're being negative. It makes a lot of sense. Especially because you're moving on to the next project, and what's going to be the next Parallel? What's going to be this? When it's going to be that? And honestly, I don't even want to use the same wording of like, what's going to be the next Parallel? What's going to be the next Jason Douglas original? And this is leading me to wanting to ask you about Jane American, because just like Parallel, Jane American has an amazing story as well. So can you talk about the story of creating it and just what the story is about?
Yeah. So this was always going to be next, because Parallel is, you know, itself, it's completely self-contained. You know, it's this one, you know, graphic novel that when you get to the end, you go back, you reread it, and it reads completely different the second time. I love rereadability. I love that. I you know, as a fan, as much as I love my X-Men, I don't know about reading, you know, 50 years of it straight where the characters don't age. I like a story that maybe has a beginning, middle, and end, and then it's so good that you like come back and read it again and you can enjoy it just as much second time through. I'd rather read those 75 issues of Sandman over and over again. Jane was always coming next. Jane is also very personal to me, but for different reasons. You know, Parallel is me scratching this itch for myself. It's this itch in the back of my head that's been there for decades. It's, can I do this? And it's a personal story in the fact that we all go through that existential dread about time passing. This one's different. So it's a World War II coming of age story. Okay. It takes place in historic Plymouth, Michigan, which is where I grew up. My parents grew up and my grandparents grew up. And during the war years, our protagonist, Jane, is kind of, she's living a life of family, stability, hope. Until she's not. Until war literally brings tragedy to her front doorstep and everything changes. And she's changed in unbelievable ways. Hint, hint, wink, wink. There's your genre. In ways that are better left hidden. Okay. But there's these economic realities at the end of the war. Dad's not coming home. Mom, through societal restraint, is no longer to be allowed to be a rose of the river and make a living for the family. So Jane is left with this choice. She can stay safe. She can stay hidden. Or she can embrace who she really is and now, hint, hint again, what she can now really do for the sake of everybody that she loves. Now, this is full of those universal relatable themes about identity, about self-worth, about self-fulfillment, about being who you are in a world that tells you something different, okay? Insert your metaphor of choice here. Inclusive. Superpower. Right, in a world that doesn't have those. But it's also deeply personal to me, as I mentioned, because it is named after and inspired by my late grandmother who went through all of that 80 years ago. It is dedicated to every single kid who's gone through my classroom, who in the 21st century, where this stuff should have been put to bed, are still struggling with those questions of identity right now. And then this is much more recent, and this is much more raw, and I got to be careful how I say this or I will weep on your podcast. But it's also very much dedicated now to my late grandfather, who was instrumental in the research process of this book. And maybe we can talk about that. But just last year, at the age of 99, when this World War II veteran realized he wasn't going to see 100, he made me promise that the book that contains the name and likeness of his high school sweetheart would see print. So this is me fulfilling that promise to him. There's family names in the book. There's an exhaustively researched, realistic book that has real places and real events, all while in that trappings of, you know, comic book nerddom that we love, and a story that hopefully relates to people of all ages, but is a little more accessible to even a slightly younger audience that where Parallel isn't. You know, I use bad words in Parallel. Those are adult themes, and this one is accessible to anybody, because we all have to grow up and we all have got to deal with a world who tells us no in a space where we know that's really us. And I'm hoping that's where that connects to people.
I honestly fell in love with the story of Jane American when you sent me the message, and then I looked on the Kickstarter. Once again, I haven't read it yet, but even just doing my own little research, like looking into it and then reading all the information and reading the story behind why you wrote it. It was very touching, and it was also very, it just meant a lot, especially when it came down to the fact that you're making a coming of age story that speaks to a lot of different people. And it's very interesting. Was this similar to what, like you said, Parallel was in the back of your mind? Was this a story that was in your mind, or was it something that just the gears started turning the more you thought about it?
I mean, the genre stuff of it, right? The fact that you've got an individual who can do things that other people can't. And then having to keep that hidden or keep that open because, you know, I talk about this with eighth graders sometimes. We do like this prompt at the beginning of this of school, and it's like, you know, if you had flight or invisibility, or if you woke up and you were invisible, what would you do with it? And smart kids always inevitably get to the point where they go, oh my God, that would be terrible. I would never want to be invisible, because if nobody else can do this thing in the world, we do the same thing with mind reading, you know, would you want this? And there's always some kid who goes, no, that's a nightmare. Because if I'm the only one and they find out, I'm in a lab by the end of the week being weaponized or dissected. Right.
Ooh.
This is, you can't, ooh. Sixth graders can't do that. Sixth graders can't do that. Eighth graders are just self-aware enough to be thinking on that level. And it always blows me away every year when it happens. Right. And so you've got this character where dad not coming home from the war triggers something. And now she's faster and stronger and, you know, some of the basics of superpowers, and she can do all these things. But like, that's a world where, you know, what I liked about X-Men, you know, back in the 60s, it's got the mutant metaphor, and you're allowed to use the mutant metaphor to be a stand-in for civil rights. You're allowed to use the mutant metaphor to be a stand-in for a bunch of different things, but it wasn't also overt. I think when X-Men is at its best, I talked about this with somebody a couple of weeks ago, is when the mutant metaphor is the big umbrella, and you can find your inclusion no matter who you are, right, in that, but then the representation is also directly in the book. And you've got people of color who are now, it's not a token character, right? It's half the cast. It's not the one female character. It's not the one queer character. It's like, it's, you know what I mean? It's like real representation. And the mutant metaphor covers the people who can see themselves because they're on the fringe of even one of those minority groups. And so like the idea of Jane being a teenage female in the 1940s and then 1946, right, post-war, is automatically the real representation of, man, you're not part of the workforce. You aren't, not only you're not going to be accepted as a woman in the workforce because they all just got sent home when the vets came home, but you're freaking 15. You have no place in this factory, right? You are a girl. Get in your place. And at the same time, you have the superhero metaphor of staying safe, staying hidden, staying closeted. And it like, I wanted to play with that thing that the X-Men now does so well of real representation of real characters, right? Like the people of color in my book come from the reality of the situation that was happening in this part of Southeastern Michigan at the time. There was this neighborhood called Canton Commons. It was just to the south of Plymouth. And it was government subsidized houses that was created to draw people up during the Great Migration to populate those factory jobs, you know, build the tanks and build the bombers, right? And yet, as soon as the war is open, guess who doesn't have jobs when white soldiers come home? Every woman who worked in the factory and every black dude that worked in the factory. You go home. We don't need you anymore. You did your job. So like there's hit, like one of the stretch goals we hit in the Kickstarter is a teacher's guide and end notes in the back. And like all that stuff's in there. Cause it's like, it's, one of my favorite types of fiction is the kind where you are entertained to no end. You find some meaning in it maybe, but you also learn some stuff. It's that fiction that you can trust that is also historically accurate, right? It isn't Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. You know what I mean? It's like when Abe shows up in my book, he doesn't, it's 1940s, but when Abe shows up in my book, it's going to be Abe. You know what I'm saying? And so like when this group of people or that group of people is represented, it's because these were the real people at this place at the time going through this stuff. It just so happens that one of my characters can lift a couple tons of steel above her head and has to decide if that's something she wants to hide or wants to go forward with. And so what I did that. Was because, you know, this is almost getting back to I'm so running around all the questions you asked, but like, this is getting back to something I think you asked earlier. Like, why this one? And I've got the burn was the personal stuff with the family, right? This is my grandma and grandpa that I'm paying tribute to. But the other thing, it's the kids in the class, right? It's the kids of every shape, size, make, color, orientation that I have watched in the 21st century still struggle with people saying, no, you're not right. You don't fit. And yet here I am, a middle-aged white dude telling a story about, you know, there's not a, the middle-aged white dudes are not the center of the story. In fact, one of them is like the villain. You know what I mean? So even though maybe of all the middle-aged white dudes who write stuff about people that aren't them, maybe I've got a little bit of leeway because I am this hopefully empathetic beating heart at the center of kids' education. And if I'm doing my job right, I got to be able to feel and hurt and love and educate everybody. Maybe that buys me leeway, but then again, maybe somebody reads that and sees the picture of me and goes, you got no right to talk about, you know, my story or whatever. So like one of the things that I did, and I just happened to get, it happened to be the most beautiful confluence of events where our creative team, if you look at my, you know, meet the creative team on there, man, we are a coalition of every make and model of human on the planet. My good friend, Randy Pink, who is a best-selling, New York Times best-selling young adult fiction novelist. And she wrote, we became friends when I got her book into the school district that I teach in as curriculum for a unit that we do. And it is... It's a teenage love story, but it takes place during the Tulsa race massacres in 1921 and on Black Wall Street. That's what it accumulates with. And she's
what's the name of that book? I'm curious.
Like, it's called Angel of Greenwood, and it is worth your time and your money today. It is a gorgeous work of historical fiction in that model that I'm modeling after myself. In fact, there's about 8 Easter eggs in that book. One of my characters has Randy's middle name. A bunch of my characters are named, or there's situations where references to her story, actually references to Tulsa. There's characters that connect tangentially through what happened there in 1921. She did all this work through her novel. It's this piece of brilliant historical fiction that brings to light one of those things that we swept under the rug as a country about this terrible tragedy that we did at the most brilliant, flourishing Black community at the height of Jim Crow. And it's wiped off the planet in, you know, 2 days in 1921. And then it's not until 100 years later that we start digging up the actual facts and Congress starts talking about it. You know what I mean? And she's one
sidebar,
of my editors.
Sidebar, sorry to interrupt you. I'll cut this out. But sidebar, did you hear about how there's only one living person from the entire situation, and recently they threw her case out in the court?
So I've been following that. So terrible. Like one of the things, so when we read Angel Greenwood third market period now for the last 3 years, because she published in 2021. Okay. And you know, 100 year anniversary, maybe 2022. And one of the like an anticipatory set, like before we dig into the book, before we start chapter one, we take there's this great Smithsonian has got this great virtual tour of downtown Black Wall Street of Green.
Really?
Yeah. And this Black family owned this. Here's the butcher shop.
That's
amazing.
Here's
the hat maker. Here's the pictures, what it looks like after they burned it to the ground. It's this virtual tour. We do that. And then there's this great interview with, at the time, 107 at the time. It's probably the person we're talking about. And she's like testifying in front of Congress, like at the 100 year thing, saying, here's what I lived through. I just bookmarked an article on CNN the other day because the outgoing mayor of Tulsa is still really, really pushing to keep the archaeological digs going. And they just found another 3 bodies that had the bullet wounds in it. Just proving, because, you know, there's these mass graves. And like the estimation in the 100 years since has been about 300 murders on that night. But like, oh, maybe. When you sweep something under the rug, it's really easy to kind of say, maybe that happened, maybe that didn't. And they keep on finding the burial sites and they're noticing bullet wounds and stuff like that that suggests it's like execution style before they did the other damage in town. So Randy Pink's one of my editors. So she protected me against, you know, white savior complex at the end. And she made sure that like, you know, when my characters of color are speaking, that I'm not stepping over some kind of line, because like I want it to be real, right? Because we're talking 1946. It was not a beautiful time for that kind of interaction, even in, you know, southeastern Michigan. And yet you don't want, I don't want to step over any line, because I want every single person, I don't care what you look like, I don't care where you come from, I want you to be able to look at this thing and find not only empathy for the characters, but find a piece of yourself in there. And it doesn't matter what the character looks like or who the character is or what gender they are. Like, there are so many characters in this book that you should be able to see yourself in and go, oh God, I felt that. Whether you've experienced that exact thing or not, that's always my goal, right? It's something I work really hard on with the eighth graders. Like, empathy is what's going to make our world survive. You know, like, people being able to not just be sympathetic or feel sorry for other people, to be actually walk in their shoes and feel empathy for them. That's what makes this world a magical, beautiful place. So I'm hoping to impart a little bit about that. And one of the ways I did that was I have this super talented team of, like I said, just a whole mess of different types of people bringing their perspective to it, whether it's a 22-year-old, you know, female artist, to a couple of female editors, to a slightly younger than me, bearded white dude, but bald, letterer and art designer. I mean, it's just bringing a Fool Richardson. A Fool Richardson. Even if you don't know that name, you know her because she does the best Black Panther covers for Marvel. She wrote my foreword. She's awesome. You know, Sina Grace, icon, now best-selling author and a Superman artist for DC, cut his bones on X-Men and Iceman over at Marvel, and was Robert Kirkman's editor on Walking Dead for the first few years of his career. He did that beautiful wraparound hardcover with me, for me. Lauren Nalepa, who is a public school teacher like me, an art teacher in actually Plymouth Canton schools where the story takes place, who is about to become a much more famous comic book creator than I am. NDA right now, we're not allowed to talk about it, but a deal may have been cut and she's about to explode on the scene, did our wraparound soft cover. And like, I'm so proud of all the work that everybody put into it. And I think they are too. I'm just really excited for this thing to be in the world. And now we're here with like a week to go in this campaign. And I think the big thing is, you know, go explore that page, look at it, see if it's something you'd be interested in, whether what we talked about today, or like you said, when you explored the page, I got a lot of information on there, but I kept it simple. And I think for people who support indie comics and for people who dig into Kickstarters, I think I want to get into the financial thing, because I want to talk about something that I hope is unique about this particular campaign. Number one, and this was a plan from day one. I got down at the bottom of it. I don't know if you got down to the bottom of the page, but I got my transparency section where I made my.
I did. I was looking at it.
So this campaign cost $23,000. But I knew from day one, whether it was my gut telling me or people smarter than me and more experienced than me telling me also, you're not going to be able to pull that off, no matter what parallel garnered as far as cultural capital or fan base or whatever. Like, you can't move on and you're not raising $23,000. You got to do this one shot first, proof of concept. So that's the way we ran it. But I knew that even if the one shot was successful, which it was, of Jane American, I'm still not making, you know, I don't have enough fans, friends, or family that love me that much to hit 23 grand, you know? Mm-hmm. And so my plan from day one is I'm not going to pay myself back for my original investment in the one shot. Entire creative team besides me gets paid for the work that they did. And if we hit any stretch goals, if we go beyond our original publishing goal, I'm not taking a penny. Every single penny of that one shot got funneled into the graphic novel that we're working on right now, to defray the cost and make it much more affordable. Because what I care about, listen, I'm a public school teacher, my friend. I make 12 cents a year. I'll be fine. I'm a public school teacher.
Wait a minute.
We are rolling in it. Fame and fortune for days.
You know, honestly, you're a lot richer than I thought, because I thought it was 5 cents. So
no, man, I got a raise. We got a new contract this year. I am up to 12.
Oh, well, you know what? Hide the money, y'all. There's poor people around. Whew, my bad. I was wrong.
There are two dimes and two pennies in my mattress as we speak. I am putting it away.
Okay, next time I see you, if you got a mink coat on, that's why.
So defray the cost that way, right? Some more personal investment for me because I want this book in people's hands. Then the next thing I did, and this is a much more recent decision. As much as I loved doing the one shot and having some really awesome collector covers, like we got this soft touch laminate that looks old and feels old, and we had this chromium cover, and there was something, the reader in me was really fighting against the collector in me. The collector in me gets Kickstarter inflation, an exclusive cover by a big name artist. You can only get it here. It's fancy. You're going to pay a premium for that. You know, a book that is, you know, a 32 page one shot like ours was, is going to price out at $5, $6, $7 tops on a normal comic shelf rack. But you get that chromium cover and it's an exclusive. Suddenly it's a $30 book. Suddenly it's a $20 book. Suddenly it's a $50 book, whatever. And the reader in me bristled against that to some level. So what I did with this, if you go into our Kickstarter right now and look at this 132-page graphic novel that now that we hit a stretch goal of all the back matter, it's going to be a big, fat 150-page book. You look at a 150-page hardcover and softcover on a normal Kickstarter with these exclusive covers, and suddenly, I mean, that's a softcover that's going to cost you $50, and that's a hardcover that's going to cost you about $100. And it didn't interest me. I made sure the price points were exactly what they would be or a little bit below what it would be on a bookshelf, on an LCL's shelf, on a local comic shop shelf, on a Barnes & Noble shelf. So our soft cover, as big and fat as it is $20. Our hard cover, as gorgeous as it is with that wraparound cover, is only $40. Again, not financially beneficial to me, but a price point that if there's some teenager who really wants to read this story, they can afford it. If you want to get a second copy because you know your mom's going to dig it and she's going to be able to relate to some of it because she comes from an era where she was said no to because of her gender, you can afford it. And that means more to me than any financial gain. Look, let's say this last week of the campaign, it's one of those like last minute bubble explosions and it goes even more and more and we hit our fifth stretch goal and all this other stuff. I'm still going to be underwater, but I don't care. This, I hope I've imparted how much this story means to me, and the sooner I can get it into people's hands and the more affordably, that's all I care about. That's all I care about. There might be another step after it, right? Maybe I tour it. Maybe I shop it to Scholastic or a bigger publisher, and then maybe someday there's some kind of thing where, you know, a couple of dollars comes to me, but it's not my priority. It wasn't my goal on day one. It's certainly not my goal here with a week to go. My goal is to get this story that means a lot to me and I hope will mean a lot to other people into their hands. Oh, wait. I forgot. It almost sounds like with this campaign, the reader half of me beat back and completely won the collector half of me. That's what it sounds like, doesn't it? It's not quite true. The collector got in one last punch. So when, I don't know if you saw this when you were scrolling through, the collector in me, I couldn't let this go. I had to have something for my hardcore nerds. And I got a giveaway going on with this campaign. You back Jane American at any level, from digital up to the collector's pack, to even the retailer pack, okay? You are automatically entered to win for my collector hounds out there. My only slabbed copy of the original sold out parallel in one of the sold out variants. This is the Donnie Darko homage cover variant. It's a foil. It's textless. The shop that did the variant on this, they only made 100. It sold out in like 12 minutes. We saw a slab 9.6 get sold online for $400 last year. This is a 9.8, so it's the highest grade that CGC has on their record. I'm giving this away to one lucky backer. So if that's enough to motivate you to go back this passion project of mine, you might win this sucker. Woo! I will mail it to you.
All right. Before we wrap up this episode, I have two questions for you.
Let's do it.
First question, it's pretty simple. What are a couple of words to describe Jane in 5 words or less?
powerful, lack of self-confidence, beautiful potential. That's off the top of my head. I hope that works. I hope that's right. I think that's her.
Okay. Okay. You know, I'll take it. I'll take it.
Yeah.
Love that. All right. So, final question.
Mm-hmm.
You got Parallel. You got Jane American. Say someone on the Broadway scene, it comes to you and they tell you, hey, Jason, huge fan of both of your works. Loved both of them. I feel like they actually both have a lot of potential to be turned into a play. Of the two, but we're only going to take one. We're giving you the choice. Which one would you turn into a play?
So now I'm putting on my director cap, right? Now I'm thinking like the person who wrote a stage play every single year for like a decade. And I'm thinking logistics. And Jane, I mean, there's tornadoes. There's a tornado in Jane that she tries to chase down.
Budget does not matter.
Right, right. I'm just trying to think about like the ability to put it on stage and make it effective. I mean, Parallel's the more isolated story. Parallel maybe works better on stage for some of the interpersonal stuff, but there are scenes. God, there's scenes in Jane's that would absolutely kill on a stage. When we get our small moments between Jane and Lorna and that cross-cultural friendship that they form. When you've got that scene where there's like the confrontation at the factory and there's this folk from Canton Common who are like, why are we excluded from this? When that goes, that would just explode on the stage. I don't want to ruin it by turning it into like some kind of like one scene here and one scene there that nobody will understand or love. Oh my God, this is an impossible question. I can't believe you're ending on this. This is going to break my brain. You got to wrap things up. I could probably like spin my wheels for another half an hour talking through the pros and cons of each one. Even with the fact that it would be tough to do the two Landons, the other Landon from the other dimension talking to him on stage, you'd have to pull off something interesting to make it believable. Maybe cast twins or something like that. I think Parallel probably works on stage better. But God, there's some scenes. I'm thinking of like other plays that I wrote. There's scenes. I mean, you're gonna get tears, and you're gonna get an audience that will laugh and cheer and weep uncontrollably if you put Jane on stage. But I think Parallel works better on stage as is.
Okay.
So that's me hedging my bets, giving you an answer without actually committing to the answer.
Okay.
I could be a politician.
Okay, wait. So in your heart of hearts, Parallel is your choice. Like, does it matter if it's going to work on stage or not?
Now you're trying to press me on the thing. You're going to make me dance around it again. I think Parallel works better on stage as written. I think you have less logistical problems. I think you lose less of Parallel with the transfer. Okay. I think there are scenes in Jane that would do to an audience what I would want done to a live audience better than anything in Parallel. But I think you would lose the grandeur of it, right? You would lose the scope of it. It's very hard in that box to show what she can really do and how small she is in this larger world, even though she's maybe the most powerful person in it. That's really, really hard to transfer onto the stage. So you lose big, massive pieces on it, even though the stuff that you could keep would be the most powerful stuff you could put on stage. So I think Parallel transfers better because you get to keep almost all of it.
Okay. All right.
Can you tell that I've never been asked that question before? Could you smell the smoke coming through the camera and see the gears turning as I'm trying to work through this and still make my answer entertaining instead of me just going, give me a half an hour, and like you see the computer rebooting as I'm like trying to figure it out? That's a good, tough question.
Like I said, this is Hot Ones. We asked some really random questions to show that I did my own research. So
Yeah.
All right. You guys heard it here first. We talked about Jane American, and we also talked about Parallel. And we got to sit down and get to know him, Jason Douglas. Have you read Parallel? Are you going to be reading Jane American? Be sure to let us know on Instagram at Super Saturdays Podcast, TikTok at Super Saturdays Pod, and Twitter at Super Saturday PC. Where all of your messages and your reviews can make their way on the show. This was Super Saturdays. I'm Damon, and
I'm Jason.
And where can the soups find you, Jason?
Listen, public school teacher, I only got one piece of social media. You can find me on Instagram, okay, at J Douglas Writes. You can't miss me. I got a dumb little avatar of me in a hospital gown flexing right after colon cancer surgery, holding on to an IV, pretending I'm a superhero that I'm not. And I will chat you up. You drop me a DM. And then obviously for the next week, Kickstarter.com, right? Look up Jane American, the graphic novel, look up Jason Douglas. And if you've got a couple extra bucks and that sounds interesting to you, I would love your backing. I would love your support. I'll get you a book in your hands by the end of the year.
So as always, see you next Saturday. Or actually, wait, this is going to be a bonus episode. See you soon, Supes.